When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
And welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Dr. Kaveh Hoda. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. I'll be your host. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, we're a relatively informal medical podcast, and we cover the intersections of public health and pop culture, social justice, and more. And if this is indeed your first episode, you're coming on to kind of a different one. And you might be a little confused because sometimes I want to cover medicine and sometimes I just want to talk about why the Spartans may be overrated. And we'll talk about that too. So don't worry, we'll usually find some medical connection, and there's a couple places here where we will too. So we have a real special episode. But before I get to it, I want to welcome new sponsors to the podcast. This episode of House of Pod is brought to you by Aronson's Recapitation Services. That's right, Aronson's Recapitation Services. Don't lose your head. Call Aronson's. My co-host today is none other than my good friend Will Poole, otherwise known on the internet as Christy Yamaguchi Main. Will, welcome back.
Thanks, buddy. I appreciate you having me back. I'm excited to talk about this book.
Yeah, we are going to talk about a book today.
Yeah, yeah.
And you guys, I make you do a lot of reading, don't I?
You do, you do. I dropped out of college for a reason. I did not plan to go back. I do not appreciate you inviting me to these episodes. I have a good time, but I still don't appreciate it. So I just want to throw that out there. You're an asshole for that.
I love making you read. There's something about it that's a lot of fun to me.
If you don't make me read, then I'm going to stick with just strictly reading tweets all day. So I do
Mad Magazine and
it.
Tweets. Yeah, yeah. Well, we're going to talk about a new book called The Killing Ground, a biography of Thermopylae. And it's written by two lovely gentlemen, one of which has been on the show before, Mike Cole and Michael Livingston. Mike and Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us.
Appreciate it.
We're going to have to play it by ear, see how this goes, but I'm going to probably go Mike Cole for Mike and then Michael or Mike Livingston for other Mike. Does that sound fair?
Yeah, you can also say Dr. Livingston, I presume. He has a PhD and I am not.
That helps. I might go with that.
Kaveh, I wanted to see if I could lead with the first question, which is, Michael, how much shit do you give Mike for spelling his name with a Y? And also, I just realized when you say Mike Cole fast, it just sounds like you're saying Michael.
I know, it's confusing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's confusing as hell. So, like, you're clearly the superior mind in this, right? In this endeavor, correct?
Just because I confirm that. Yes, he is clearly.
Spell your name like a sane person, right?
Yeah, we've been on sets together, and they called me Doc and they called him Mike because they're like, we just can't. There's no filling with it at all. I don't know what he does with his why, but you know, why not?
Nice, nice.
There's no I in team, folks, and there's no I in mine.
Let me introduce you guys a little bit to our listeners. Correct me if I'm wrong. Mike with a Y, long career in military intelligence, in the military and law enforcement, also fights fires, apparently. We had him on an episode a couple of months back to discuss his book, The Bronze Lie, Shattering the Myth of Spartan Warrior Supremacy. Great episode. I recommend you check that out. Joining us also, as I mentioned, is Dr. Livingston, Dr. Michael Livingston, a two-time winner of the Distinguished Book Award from Society for Military History. Is that correct? Right? Okay.
That's correct.
And a distinguished professor at the Citadel, the Military College of South Carolina, and an elected fellow of the Royal Historical Society. Did that come with like a robe? That sounds awesome.
I tell you, it's better than working for a living.
Nice. So this new book is this really interesting look. And we were joking about, you know, me making Will read it because it was fun to read. It's a really interesting look at the history of war and geography and the making of myths in this one specific place. Before we get to that, Mike with a Y has been on the show before. Mike Livingston, you're new to the show, so we're going to ask you a question that we ask every new guest when Will is on the podcast. It's a hypothetical situation.
Right on.
Will smiling because he knows where I'm going with this.
I don't know how I'm the one. Did I tweet this? Is this
you
my?
You tweeted this.
Am I the one that put this forbidden question in your head?
You're the one that put this cursed question out into the world.
All right. All right. All right. Go ahead.
So, Dr. Livingston.
Yes.
Say you're in a relationship with a lovely young lady and she is cursed by an evil witch, and the evil witch or sorcerer has somehow gotten your loved one's mind and swapped it with the mind of your mother. So their minds are in separate bodies now. In their body, your girlfriend's mind is now in your mom's body and vice versa. And there's only one way. Only one way to undo the curse. Dr. Livingston is like, what kind of fucking medical podcast is this? There's only one way to undo the curse, and that is you have to have sex with one of them. What do you do? We covered this before, but I'd love to hear your answer.
This is an academic exercise, I understand.
Correct. Yes.
Something of a psychological exercise, one yes. might say.
Oh, it's like a real saw torture. Situation. Yeah.
It's more torture.
It is a saw situation.
Yes.
You're gonna cut that off or not?
You don't have to answer this. You don't have to answer this. It's a terribly unfair question.
I don't even remember this question. Did I answer that question?
Yeah, you did.
You did.
What did I say?
It was weird. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it right now.
Let's not bring it up.
Guys, don't worry. Someday we are going to look back on this moment, laugh nervously, and change the subject.
And fast forward.
If you want, I can tell you what the answer is. I figured it out.
You figured it out.
Yeah. Here's what you do. With everyone's consent, you put your mother's mind in your girlfriend's body into a very deep propofol sedation with an anesthesiologist who knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
Not a cardiologist the way that like Michael Jackson would do.
No.
And that way it's her, your girlfriend's body, and your mom's mind is in there, but it's gone. It's shut down. Boom, it's gone.
Yep.
So that way, again, with everyone's consent with this, that way you can get it done. And it's pretty much as close as you can get to not having your mother there.
Yeah.
That is a terrific medical solution to a problem that I hope we don't encounter.
Yeah.
Well, you know, God willing.
This is the reason I don't hang out a lot with sorceresses.
Or doctors.
Dear clear. Yeah, or doctors.
Both are trouble. And I'm just kidding. We never ask that question except for when Mike Y is here.
He's on the podcast for us. My fault. Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of him that makes me do it. Okay. So before we get any further, let me start by asking this question. This book is about Thermopylae in Greece, and I think as you described it, sort of kind of close to, just a little bit off center on the eastern side of Greece, not an incredibly important city in and of itself, to my understanding, but it is the site of many battles that you guys go over in great detail, and it's such an important battleground. What is it about this place that makes it so important? Why is it the center of so many battles over time?
Let me take a first stab at that. The first thing to keep in mind here, and this is what's so incredible about it, is that Thermopylae is, you know, arguably one of the most naturally defensible places on Earth. And this is at the time of the most famous battle, 480 BC. Over time, of course, it's pretty active geologically. 2,500 years is an eye blink in geologic time, but Thermopylae is pretty active. And the landscape today looks totally different, something that we discuss in the book. But that defensibility is the first factor, right? Is that you have a natural fortress, which is, offers a lot of the same features as very expensive and difficult fortresses to build, especially given the technology that's available to you in the ancient world. The next thing is its location. So it is astride the Mediterranean basin, and the North African coast is incredibly rich. And you have to remember that in the ancient world, sea travel is intensely dangerous. Well, you have the Cyclades, you have Rhodes, you have you have Crete, you have all of these islands that you can hop on these shallow keeled boats, ships rather, that need to put in frequently, that need to hug the coast. And we go into some detail toward the end of the book about how that shortens the sea journey and makes it a lot easier. And the Mediterranean, at least in the western portion of the world, when I say west, I mean west of the Hellespont, was sort of like the basin of expansive imperial civilization in that period. And standing astride that, you know, southern Greece with all of its shoreline and the, you know, Athens, which is an incredibly important city, accessing that becomes really important. But who is accessing that? And here Greece has something else that's really important and powerful. And unfortunately, it's the same thing that Ukraine is experiencing, which is that if you look at Ukraine's history, just like Greece's history, it is smack dab in the middle of extremely powerful imperial forces that need to get at each other so they can beat each other up. They have to go through this central terrain to do it. So when you have this choke point that's incredibly defensible, and it's in between Europe and the Byzantine Empire and Rome and the successor states of Alexander and Italy and Germany during World War II, you're going to see a lot of transit. The Ottoman Empire that's expanding as Turkey sort of explodes. The Persians, we've talked about that already, Kaveh. And, you know,
yeah, we'll talk about them again.
Yes,
just keep like talking about them.
Sorry, we never get tired of talking about it. They got to go across this, right? And in the middle of this, and it's really uncanny because Greece is cut almost in half by mountains. And this pass in the classical period, it's like, imagine a wall and there's one door in it. If you want to go anywhere, like you got, I mean, I'm exaggerating. You can, there are ways around it. But it's basically like that, especially for large, large armies. Mike can talk to you a little bit because that's another one of his important axioms. Obviously the answer is more complex than that, but sure, to simplify it, yeah, that strategic positioning, that natural defensibility, and that luck or bad luck, as you would have it, of being sandwiched between imperial powers made that, you know, just turned that place into a vortex where tens of thousands of people were going to die.
This is a terrific choke point for anybody trying to mount a defense. If you want to block people out, this is a terrific place to do it. And so, yeah, this becomes what we think maybe some of the most blood-soaked ground in the world.
What is it like? What's the process like of writing a book with two people? Like, how did you guys break this down? Like, how does that work?
Oh, yeah. All right. So I can start with this, Mike, if that's okay. And this is important to know, is that Mike, he's more than my co-author. He's really my mentor when I began wanting to do history. Now, remember that Mike is a professional scholar.
And when he says Mike, by the way, he's referring to Michael Livingston. This is Mike Cole Livingston, talking.
That's right.
Yeah, Dr. Livingston, just so that we know whose voice is who again.
Thank you for the correction.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm what's called an autodidact, which is that I take scholarship seriously, but I had to teach myself this stuff. And one of the things I point out is, you know, look, there's certainly a lot I've learned, and I'm very, very proud of my work, but there's a huge difference between someone who, despite, you know, I did teach myself languages and really took this very seriously. I don't have 30 years of doing this full time as a professional scholar. And when I first reached out to Mike, because he was also a fantasy novelist, and said, hey, I'm a fantasy novelist. I'm wanting to work in scholarship and to do nonfiction and to do history. And he really took me under his wing in a powerful way. And really taught me a lot of historiography and the structure of how you do history and how you do research. Now, I was very lucky in that that's very similar in a lot of ways, believe it or not, to law enforcement investigation or into intelligence operations, which is stuff I had a lot of experience with. So I took to it. But already we had that really powerful and tight relationship. And I was brought up in history sort of in the way that Mike Livingston teaches other people to be brought up in it. So we already had a kind of affinity to it. And that made it really, really easy. And I think that what we would usually do is, in some cases, you know, usually one of us would do a first blush. Like one of us would say, hey, you know, this is either a chapter or a section of a chapter or something I really want to hit. Here's what I've got on it. And then throw it over the fence to the other one. And then the other one would chew it up and you know, red pen it to death. And then we would kick it back and forth that way. And also a lot of it had to do with schedules. I mean, we both have other writing projects and busy, busy lives, families outside of our writing lives. So, you know, if one of us was slammed, you know, Mike was, I think, for some of the time, actually overseas shooting for History Hit. So he's actually shooting television or at festivals. And then I would take the brunt of the first draft work and he would get to his edits later. And some of the times I was traveling for research or doing, you know, fire department stuff or family stuff, and he would take the brunt of it. So we just, I think because we already had that close relationship, it was sort of really easy to pitch to each other back and forth. It went really, really well. Mike, I don't know if you think that's accurate.
Yeah, I mean, that's accurate. I mean, it's a great question. How do two people write a book together? And there's so many different ways of doing it. I've done several books that I've co-authored. It starts, if it's going to go well, it starts with trust, right? It starts with trust that, you know, the other person is bringing something to the table. They have skills, you know, that I don't have, or, you know, we can complement each other and move back and forth. And a big part of it as well is the willingness, you know, to be wrong, right? Mm-hmm. If I, in my draft, have screwed up, whether it's a research mistake, you know, God help me, or, you know, I poorly put this together, I structured the chapter wrong or whatever, my co-author, you know, in this case, you know, Mike Cole, better call me out on that. You know, we want a good book, and I need to trust him to give me the bad news, give it to me straight. And that he's probably, you know, right on that, or if he's wrong, that we can have a very open and earnest dialogue about how to get it right. You can't work well with somebody who needs to feel like they won or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a good working relationship on something like this. And Mike Cole, to his credit, is not that kind of person, right? You know, he very much believes, as I believe, you know, we're not in the business of being right. We're in the business of getting it right, and it doesn't matter, you know, kind of, you know, who owns that result. Mm-hmm. It's the result we're after.
And by the way, to add to that, it's the same thing in TV. So when Mike and I did, you know, we were on the Discovery show Contact together. And when you do unscripted television, there is such pressure to mug the camera and to get in front of it as much as possible, because you're sharing attention with other cast members. And if you're going to get cast in future television shows, which we all want to, the more you're on that screen, the more they're seeing you. And when I was on the show Hunted on CBS, there was the production team, I think, really kind of stoked competition between cast members, and it was not friendly in that way. But being with Mike on the for Discovery, it was the same exact feeling of like throwing to each other, and like, you know, I've been talking long enough, let's get Mike some airtime. And that ease of, and sort of I don't know, like the abundance versus the scarcity mentality, where you're naturally supporting each other, that made such a huge difference in the experience of making that show and how that show came out. And it's the same ingredient writing. If you're going to be co-authoring with someone, it has got to be collaborative. It can't be competitive.
So future advice for when you do television shows together, go for memeability. Okay. GIFs, reaction images, memes, that's how you're going to get more airtime in the future. That's also why newspapers are dying and the publishing industry is that you can't make memes and GIFs out of like pages of text. You know what I mean?
No.
So just some, you know, no, I don't want to tell you guys how to do your job or anything, but you know, we gotta get you guys like circulating on Twitter. Y'all need to be like easily searchable in the keyboards.
I had a fist pump when I was on Hunted, which got made into an animated GIF, and it's probably
hell
still
yeah.
Around somewhere that was, but yeah, if Mike and I are ever lucky enough to do television again together, which I'd love to do, then we'll keep it in mind.
It's either that or like support like the worst political
candidates that you can.
Candidates, yeah. It's those are your two options to start them at this point.
Gina Carano, path to success.
Yeah, exactly.
I could totally see Dr. Livingston here, like with a meme where like Mike says something, Mike White says something, and then he like turns to the camera and he's like, "Where's the beef?" or something like that. Like, that's the meme we're going for. But what you guys are saying about working together, I think that's great advice, like for anyone that's in a partnership. I mean, I think that sort of goes along for like podcasters. It goes along for whoever is working together with people. You know, the book itself, it's funny. I'm very much a pacifist. The only books I've read about war, really real war, historical or military books are, you know, the two books we've had Mike Cole on for. So it's interesting to me still. I think this book in particular, I there was a lot to it that sort of drew me and kept me reading. And I guess, what is it for you guys? Like, what drew you guys to writing about military history? Because it seems like it's not an easy topic to do. You're going back to subjects as early as 480 BC, you know, and earlier, I assume, too, to try and get history here.
Also, just want to point out the two military books Kaveh chose, him being Persian, is about the Greeks getting their asses kicked.
Do you guys have any more books about Persians winning wars?
Can you just stomp an ass?
Can we just write more about that?
Here's the next one.
No. So yeah, what is it that draws you to military history in the first place?
Well, I'll start with this one, and then Mike can chime in. I'll say first of all, studying military history and you know, pacifism or whatever. Look, there's nothing weird about that. To study war is to not be in favor of it. You know, the more one knows about the reality, as opposed to, you know, some kind of fantastical vision of what, you know, Rambo garbage or whatever, to actually be aware of what war is like and what fighting's like, what killing's like, it's really hard to study that stuff and be kind of rah-rah about it. It's not good stuff. And, you know, especially when you get into these, you know, pre-modern kind of things, it's dirty, it's grimy, it's not good. So, you know, why study it? Lots of answers to that. I face this question a lot myself. I'm sure Mike does as well, and I'm not going to answer for him. But one of the answers that I often give is that one of the constants in humanity, sadly, is we're trying to kill each other. If you're trying to sort of find some through thread, you know, that connects culture to culture, does just human beings through history, we're trying to kill each other. And so a study of warfare, military history, is a study of humanity. And it's a study of humanity at its kind of most dramatic. You know, for better or worse, battles especially tend to lay out in very stark terms in a moment, in a very easy to kind of frame moment, you know, life and death struggle. So, you know, there's, you know, one could study lots of things, but the military history allows this, I can take a sliver here, a sliver there, and see in a window into the past in a way that is tremendously dramatic and exciting. And besides that, it's also, you know, I suppose a little bit, you know, intellectual as well in trying to understand strategy and tactics, these things that we try to explain, and their interplay, of course, with technology and terrain and all the stuff that we get into in this book. But Mike, what are you, what's your answer to this?
I mean, I would agree with you on that. The only thing I would add to it is, and I mean, not to take it to a sad place, but like, look, I went to war, right? Like I remember growing up and like being a kid who was totally impressed by this stuff and drawn to it. My mom took me to the Met to look at arms and armor when I was little, because she thought that D&D made you worship the devil. And I was constantly staring at knights and playing with swords, picking up armor. So if I could get them on to history, but that impulse to violence, like I almost feel like I was born with it. And then you go into military, you go into intelligence operations, you go overseas, you fight, and then you reach a point and you're like, what the hell did I just do? And why? And man, I will never unpack it. And I'm certainly not the first person who's had that experience to try, but there is something in the investigation of, if I'm not the only person to do something like this, like I'm not the, in fact, as Mike said, most people do things like this, or some variant of it. Actually, I don't know that most people actually go to war, but, and there's, I don't know, maybe it makes me feel better to have a little more grasp, or to at least know that I'm not alone in having committed that particular error. Mm-hmm. Like, again, I don't want to bring the mood down. It is a comedy podcast, but you asked the question, man.
This is good. I mean, something I really enjoy about both the books that we've covered in the show, the book The Bronze Lie that you wrote before this and this book, is that you don't shy away from looking at the human cost of all these things. And I can tell there are times when you guys are discussing like certain generals or like these people with these really impressive like sort of battlefield presences, where you guys are in a really cool way sort of geeking out a little bit that we can all sort of appreciate, you know, we get it. But you don't shy away from also discussing the human cost of it, and that at the end of the day, this is about mostly young men dying. Yeah, for some pretty soft causes a lot of times. Yep. And you guys don't shy away from that. So I really appreciate it. And I will say this, I'm a gastroenterologist. So I do colonoscopies a lot. So I understand the loaded question of, why do you do this? Something I get from patients a lot, where they're just like, why do you do this?
What is wrong with you?
What is wrong with you is what they're saying. You know what I mean?
You're also, you know, you're also probably really good at sensing bullshit. Is that correct?
Correct. I know an asshole when I see one.
But hold on a second. Like that is a great, but there's a great commonality there, because like, yeah, look, here's like a dirty, like gross, essential part of being human. Right. And it's a puzzle, and understanding how it works and why it works is sort of like part of solving the mystery of life. Right. And it's also like, things just sort of are, we tell ourselves stories about them, whether they're good or they're bad. And the only way to really to get to the bottom of those judgments is to really investigate it. And like, man, war and organized violence is every bit as bad as poop. I mean, like it's, arguably a heck of a lot worse.
I would say it's worse.
It involves a lot of poop.
Right. It sure
generally
is.
Like when you get into the nitty gritty, like there, yeah, it's
people crapping themselves.
First you say it, then you do it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but but like, dude, and also there's something really wrong with the values of our society that people are making movies celebrating and lionizing people that go around murdering each other and not gastroenterologists.
Yeah,
they're doing a hell of a lot more good point. For the world. That's a good point. They should make an action movie about you.
I have a great idea, Hollywood, if you're out there listening. Dr. Kaveh Hoda, forensic proctologist. I solve crimes through the dead anus.
Oh my God.
I'm just saying, think about it. I see like it could be a CSI spinoff at least.
Here he comes. He brought the snake. Look out, everybody.
speaking of poop and bad things, let's take a quick break to get some commercials and then we will be right back.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, we're back. Wow, those are really great commercials about dick pills. So we all agree, right? So let's get back to the book here. The book is a little different in what I've like read before in terms of like history books, and that specifically what we're talking about is just this one place, that not one army the whole way through. We're talking about this one place, Thermopylae. And we're talking about why there's so many battles there and the geography, how that plays into it. That was kind of an interesting twist to me, that there was this one place that's so central to so many battles that involved everyone from like possibly the Huns, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, the Byzantines, the Nazis. Like it was this one place. And you say in your book that a battle is its ground. Can you explain what you mean and why you chose to write a book about a place?
Mike, that's got to be you.
Well, in a sense, it's kind of both of us. So the battle is a ground thing is like my mantra. I've written several books about battles that take this sort of approach, right? That you can't understand what's happening on a battleground, on a battlefield, until you understand the landscape, right? We're human beings. Our heads are a certain amount above the ground, right? This is how you see the battlefield. And to understand what happened there, like you have to know where it was. And so that you understand lines of sight, lines of retreat, lines of approach, you know, what they had to grapple with on the field, that ditch, you know, that hill, the forest, you have to understand the ground. And a lot of historians don't do that, frankly. They're like, well, whatever, I'll look at a map and I know what's going on. And that's not the case, I don't think. I think it really matters to understand where the ground is. And so I've kind of done a lot of projects doing this and kind of, I don't know, sort of become known as like the guy who finds battles, right? You know, we don't know where this battle is. Livingston will go find it. And that's fun. That's cool. Like I said, it's better than working for a living. That Thermopylae, however one wants to pronounce it, is such an extreme instance of this, because as you said, it has so much warfare in one spot over such a long period of time, right? We're talking 2,500 years, probably, and then some, of fighting in one location. And it becomes this opportunity to study kind of like what I like to do, which is, what is the landscape? Okay, how does technology, tactics, all this stuff combine on landscape? The stuff I love to do in a single instance, whether it's the the Battle of Agincourt, the Battle of Crecy, Battle of Hastings, whatever. You know, I do this in these individual cases. Here we're going to do this through time in a single place. And honestly, the idea for doing that, that came from Mike with a Y, Mike Cole. That came from Mike because he brought to my attention. And at one point he was just texting me. He just texted and was like, oh my gosh, everybody knows the one battle of Thermopylae, the 300, you know, from the movie. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is Sparta, kick, whatever. Everybody knows that story.
We're big fans of it on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
We're really, it's all really intriguing. Yeah,
that was my extent of research for this podcast.
Yes. Yeah,
so you watched the documentary then.
I read the comic too. So yeah. I did a little bit more of a deeper dive.
No,
I read the literature on it.
Stomach is the Vaseline on the stomach is a very important part of any.
So were the rhinoceros. The rhinoceros were present too.
100%.
Or the dudes dressed like Beyonce throwing clay pots that were on fire, I guess.
Well, we do that sometimes, if I'm being fair. That's
Tuesdays.
We have traditions. We have our traditions.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Not to knock you off what you were saying, but I would like, before the episode is over, I would like to get a Mount Rushmore from both of you of dudes, your personal Mount Rushmore of dudes who fought at Thermopylae over its history. So like your personal Mount Rushmore, because I was reading in that opening chapter where you're setting up the book and stuff, you list all of these people and I'm like, oh shit, I've heard of that guy. Well, I heard of that guy before, you know, like, so like, I'm sure, you know, y'all might have personal favorites as far as tacticians and generals or famous people.
No, this is great. This is an awesome question.
That's a legit question.
And this totally tacks onto what Mike was saying about this being a laboratory of war. Look, if you look at the Battle of, I don't know, of Little Bighorn, you're only going to see how the 7th Cavalry fought against, you know, combined Oglala Lakota and other Plains natives on that one time. The cool thing about Thermopylae is the terrain does change, but you're getting to see how would people in the Bronze Age have fought here? How would people in the Iron Age have fought here? What happens when you have mechanized vehicles? What happens when you have, you know, flintlock guns? Like, you know, all of that is a cool experiment. So the characters that are interesting, obviously some of them are interesting for reasons of fame. And some of them are interesting for other reasons. So the first one I'm going to pull is Marianus, who in 254 AD, we only know the name Marianus, is probably, that's the Latin name, the Roman name of a Greek, who is a garrison commander at Thermopylae, defending it from the Goths. And this is, we only know about this because of palimpsest. This is a piece of text that was, you know, in the medieval monks used to scrape paper, right? So they could reuse it because paper was expensive back then. You couldn't just wad it up and go to Walgreens and get another ream of it, right? So they wanted to write prayers over an ancient text. They scraped it off. They wrote their prayers. And in 2014, we finally had the technology to look beneath that text at what they had scraped off. And we saw ancient texts that told us of two more battles. So it was this amazing detective story. But what I love about Marianus is it's 254 AD. It's a group of Greek peasants. They're about to be overwhelmed by Goths that are coming south. And Marianus gives this incredible speech that we have captured in the book. And he's reminding them of Leonidas and the Spartans from 300. And I love this because, look, imagine that, Kaveh. Like, you guys now in 2024, you know the movie 300, and you know the story of Leonidas, and you're kind of, you know, we're making fun of it here because the movie stank, but like, the story itself is something that you geek out on in 2024, and brother, you have that in common with these early medieval people. They geeked out on that story too, and he was giving that speech to inspire people. You are fighting in the place where Leonidas died, you know, which I just love, and the fact that this speech was so. I'm sorry to put that on my Mount Rushmore, but I'm putting it there. Next dude I want to bring up is Boniface of Montferrat, who is the Mike. Help me out here. Is he the king of the Thessalonic kingdom at the time, or is no? He is not. He is an Italian knight who participated in the Fourth Crusade. and was a major power player against this Byzantine administrator, Leoscoros. And this is in 1214 AD, who took Thermopylae. He was sort of rising up against the disintegrating Byzantine Empire that was collapsing under the face of the Fourth Crusade, and tried to hold Thermopylae against this Italian knight who smoked this dude out of the pass, drove him back to Corinth, and shut him up there on the citadel of Corinth. And finally, in despair, this dude rode his horse, literally rode it off the cliff on the edge of the... So, like,
oh, shit.
That's pretty badass.
Yeah, that's awesome. Don't know,
like, he Thelma and Louised it? Like, is that...
Yeah, he did. Totally.
He did. He did.
Those are my two non-famous... No one's heard it. Well, actually, I think probably if historians have heard of Boniface of Montferrat, but it's not a household name.
Right, right. Then, Michael, are either of those guys on your personal Mount Rushmore? Or is Mike
got those his... Those are legit. Those are legit. Okay. I mean, yeah, you know, obviously...
If there was any crossover here or not between y'all.
Well, Mike, you gotta pick somebody from Rogue Mail.
What? I'm sorry?
Rogue Mail.
So the last thing that we cover in the book, the last combat action in the past, actually takes place in World War II. And it's by a special operations group, so special forces essentially. Who have dropped in, parachuted in, these British fellows. Hello.
Indeed.
yes, indeed. And they've dropped in to create, you know, sabotage, essentially, in occupied Greece.
Guns of Navarone style. Love it.
Oh, it's straight up, man. And it yep. needs to be made a movie of this thing. It's extraordinary. So, the first thing they do, they're trying to, like, blow this railway that goes up the pass, and it actually goes, this is the pass, part of the pass that is utilized in the famous 300 craziness, to bypass Leonidas. This is what the kind of go around.
Anapaea path.
Very good.
I read your book.
Gold star. Gold star.
I did the work.
So they're going to do kind of, the railway goes up this area and they want to try and blow it. There's three viaducts, bridges, essentially, that they kind of target. They blow one of them up pretty quickly with the help of locals. But the big one that they want to blow is so difficult to reach that the locals are like, you just can't, man. You would have to have like 1,000 men and you'd lose half of them to do this job. And we're not going to do it. And this group of these British special operators are like, let's give it a shot anyway. And they decide that they'll do this through this canyon that nobody's gone down. No human being has descended this canyon. It's a crack in the earth. It's absolutely extraordinarily horrific terrain. And they do this with like no gear. They're, you know, if I was to do this, I'd be in a wetsuit, you know, I'd have carabiners, all this kind of stuff. They're like in their shorts and sneakers, trying to do this. They're like, oh, we need rope. I guess let's take the parachutes that we made and like make rope out of the parachutes to like manage this stuff. Cut down a tree, float it down the river. Let's see if we can use that. That they somehow get all the way down. They end up blowing the bridge. It's this absolutely incredible story that actually Smithsonian Magazine ran an excerpt of that chapter because it was such a cool event. But one of the figures in that party, and it's like just a handful of dudes that do this, is this guy, Gordon Creed, is his last name.
Badass name.
Yeah. It's a good British name.
Oh, totally. Totally, man. And this guy writes an autobiography that then another guy helps him with, called Rogue Mail. And it is delightful.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
he was convinced that he was the guy that James Bond was based on, because he had like known Ian Fleming. He dated oh my gosh, what was the starlet's name? It was like Greta Garbo. So like a week he was with Greta Garbo. I mean, and he talks about all the stuff he did in Greece. And it's I say kind of hilariously, even though it sounds kind of weird. I mean, it's incredibly blindedly misogynistic and like dinosaurian. You know, this guy's like, oh, and this is just how things are. And you're like, that's not okay. Like,
right.
How do you...
You're like, even for the time, that's wild, man.
He's like your classic bad old days, you know? Yeah. He's like a bad character from Mad Men, but even worse, you know?
Right,
Yeah, but he's so blind to it. I mean, which is the crazy thing. You're like, do you hear the words you're saying, man? Yeah. He's outstanding. He's so much fun.
Not to approve of it or anything, but that kind of like complete obliviousness is also probably what makes you decide to go blow up that bridge. Right. You know what I mean? Like just the 10-foot tall and bulletproof attitude is bad in many ways a lot of times, and also sometimes it helps you blow up a bridge that everybody is telling you you're an idiot for trying to do.
Right. I mean, you know, he talks about in blowing this bridge, they finally get to it, right? And they're setting explosives, and you got the one team there and they're trying to do explosives, and they've gotten the detonators down there through all this horrific rapids and all this stuff. They had to wrap them all in condoms to try and French condoms. They were very clear on that. Ooh, they need to be French condoms.
Ribbed.
Otherwise
the
they won't
pleasure.
Be waterproof. So they wrapped all the detonators up in French condoms so that the sappers are there trying to like get this stuff all wired up to blow. And he's hiding in a bush to protect them. And along comes a guard. And the way he describes killing the guard is even, as you said, this kind of like...
He jumps up, karate chop. Hi-ya!
And then, I had to hit him with my kosh, which is like a little billy club kind of thing. So I, you know, smote him across the top of the head with the kosh, and he fell into the river and never came back again. You're like, oh, hello. That dude 100% is on my Mount Rushmore of Thermopylae stuff.
Sure. Hell yeah.
That is bonkers. And that's, you know, to go back to Mike's point about the overlay of history there. I've got a postcard that's a picture of that bridge before it's blown up. It's a postcard of that bridge. And on the back of it is German. And, you know, we suspect it's from somebody who was stationed there. Might have been one of the guys who died that night. And he's describing in German, here's the bridge. And this is a bridge overlooking the Esopus River, which was crossed by the Persian immortals when they went around Leonidas to destroy the Spartans. You know, like this... mystique, this almost kind of like, I don't know, this sacred space or whatever is one of the extraordinary things about this. And, you know, to go back, you know, to this kind of how this happened, you know, Mike brought it to my attention how many battles there were. And at that point we thought there was, I don't remember what it was, 8 or 9. And we was like, wow, that's pretty wild. And then started writing this book, and yeah, we have what, 27 combat
27 actions? 27 combat actions, I think 16 or 17 battles. I can't believe I forgot. Yeah. I lost count of that
we know of, and that's really key to say here. We are there has to be more, you know, the way history kind of functions, there were surely more. These are the only ones we can find anything that we can confirm. I think there were a couple others that we were like, maybe that is, but we can't really confirm it. But these are the ones we know about.
And the important thing to remember is that this place is in the middle of nowhere. Like, this is not a major port. This is not a major agricultural area. This is not, there's no big capital city. There's no, you know, there's not a mine, you know, it isn't a major religious center, although it's possible that there was a religious site, an important religious site nearby, at least in the archaic period. And that of course raises the question, because by the time the smoke clears, yes, this is the most famous battlefield. Arguably, it's the most famous battlefield on Earth, or one of them at least. But 27 battles across 2,500 years, why? What is going on here? And that's why we really got interested in it and started picking it apart.
So even like back in medieval, like England, or Europe when, you know, from my imagination, there was just knights and serfs constantly fighting these crappy little battles for these terrible kings. Even in those places, there wasn't battlefields that saw this much action then, to your guys' knowledge.
And I'll throw you, I don't think so.
No, you can't. I mean, the closest that, you know, I think we've ever kind of circled around would be, you know, something like Jerusalem, right? That gets fought over so much through history. But that's very different in that it itself is a target,
right?
Thermopylae is not a target. Nobody is thinking, you know what I would like to you know, plant my flag on is Thermopylae. Like, that's not a thing.
Yeah.
Why not? Transit point.
Why not? It seems strategic.
Well, it's strategic as a transit, right? As a place to get through.
Gotcha.
But it's not itself a goal, right? It's something you do on the way to the goal.
I would set up a toll booth and charge my enemies to get through it. Therefore,
I'm going to start calling you Justinian, because that was exactly, well, you charge money, but Justinian the Great certainly made it as you definitely had to pay a toll in blood to get through. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in good this is one of the great things about it is that we're looking at something that is an active battle point as opposed to, this target and the way that Jerusalem might be, or, Antioch maybe. You just really don't find these kind of choke points the way that you do here. And that has a lot to do with the terrain and the topography. And we get into that, right? You know, how did this place come to be? How has it changed over the years, right? Because it's very different. You go today and it's very different from what it was in 480 when Leonidas dies there. It's very, very different terrain. How do we know that? How do we reconstruct that? Right. You know, Mike and I both have a kind of a vested interest in not, we don't want to just tell you what we think happened. We want to tell you why we know that, right? Why do we think this is the way it is? How is the sausage made, as it were?
Yeah.
We do a lot of that in getting in the terrain and all that.
You guys are very transparent about that. I like it. You know, you discussed that Leonidas, or how we pronounce, have we agreed on, is it Leonidas or
Leonidas?
Leonidas. Okay.
But also, I want to be clear, like, you know, with Greek stuff, it's and also how people pronounce things over time changes. So Leonidas is certainly allowable.
Okay, fair. Leo, because I feel like I can call him that at this point.
Again, Mike spells his name with a Y, so he's got a thing for
take it with a grain of salt.
He's contrarian when it comes to names. You know what I
mean?
I get it.
Mikey has a really good point. Mikey's got a really good point.
So you discussed that one of the thoughts was his plan was to destroy the Persian army through the three D's: desertion, disease, and disorder. You can keep them in one place long enough, those things would happen. And it's an aspect of war that I find particularly intriguing. As you might imagine, the second D, disease, is the most interesting to me as a doctor. And, you know, as someone following along the current events in the Middle East now and seeing what happens when you take a group of people, say 2 million people, and you move them into smaller and smaller and smaller places where there's no infrastructure to care for, like, their basic biologic needs, and the hygiene area gets worse and worse with time, and you see disease become rampant. Personally, I've talked about this before, but the number of deaths we're going to see in Palestine over the next couple months, even if every bomb were to stop now, will keep climbing just based on the disease that's going to run rampant through there. Mm-hmm. But this seems like it's a military strategy. Has this been something you guys have seen? Is this a military strategy that seems to have some, does it work did it work in this situation? And what's your guys' experience studying that?
Disease is a military awareness, as it is for anybody dealing with, as you said, you know, medical field, what, you know, obviously is centered on this. But anybody dealing with large groups of human beings better be aware of disease and the threats of it, especially if they are contained in one place, whether that is the thinking about the transmission of disease or the production of disease, right? You know, you put a lot of people in one place. That's not to put too fine a point on it, a lot of shit. Yeah. And that itself, right? Okay, now you've contaminated the water supply. Now you've done this. Now you've done that. Like the avalanche effect of that is enormous. And anybody who is having to deal with large groups of men, which a general, a leader, a king, on campaign knows this. And it's one of the things that you see throughout history. For instance, when it comes to any kind of siege, right? You know, the people besieged are having to face this problem. Like, how do we deal with disease? Because we can't go anywhere. We're locked in. The besiegers also have to worry about it because they're kind of locked in as well to commit the siege, right? You know, if we get up and leave, there's no siege. So we have to stay in place too. So you've got all of these people, the besieged and the siege, in one place, and the disease can run rampant. And, you know, whether or not this is a targeted tactic in a given instance, it's always going to be on the sort of the whiteboard of things I have to grapple with, things I have to contend with, mm-hmm. and things my enemy has to grapple and contend with, right? If you're a good leader, if you kind of know what you're doing, and we think Leonidas did, he knows, in this case in 480, Xerxes has all of these tens of thousands of men and the horses and, you know, the camp followers, everybody.
Rhinoceros.
This is going to be a problem. If he's stuck in one place, there's going to be disease.
Yeah.
He knows that.
Yeah. And actually, this is actually a question for you, Mike Livingston. I can't think of, I'm racking my brain because there's a common trope that you see in video games and in comic books and stuff like that of besiegers deliberately attempting to sow disease by flinging sick corpses or diseased horses or something over walls. But mm-hmm. as I rack my brain for actual source material that I've used in reporting on battles, I can't actually think of an example of that. Can you off the top of your head, Mike, from a source?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Yeah. Okay. When you're doing a siege, one of the first things you want to do is destroy the water supply. And if you can't do anything to stop the water from getting in, you try and poison the water supply. And the easiest way to do that is throw corpses in it.
Yeah, there you go.
So we see this, you know, Jerusalem, we see this all over the place. Throw bodies into the water, and you'll wreck the water supply. And the awareness of that, it's not a happy thing. It's not a good thing,
no.
But it's a remarkable thing that far back, you know, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, they knew. Yeah. They knew.
Yeah.
You throw a bunch of dead bodies in the well, and you better not be drinking it from that water.
Yeah.
They knew that, and they would try and throw upstream, right? Let's stop up the water course.
Yeah.
There's biological warfare has always been right there with us, whether it's smallpox mm-hmm. blankets or poisoning the water supply. Like, even before we knew what germ theory was or anything, we knew how to weaponize it, which is pretty, I don't know what that says about humans, humanity.
Nothing good.
Damn, yeah. Man.
Yeah, no. Nothing good.
I mean, it's sad to me that these siege tactics haven't changed that much. I mean, like, they're still happening. Like, through like mild tweaks on them, the water is being controlled one way or another, you know, access to sanitation being controlled.
Yeah, the difference is we have different names for it. Right. You know, we, as Will just said, you know, we understand, oh, we're going to put germs into this thing. Where they mm-hmm. they may not have known that. Right. But the effects of that, the downstream effects of that, literal downstream, were understood. Right. You know, you didn't know the mechanism. You know, do we even really know the mechanisms, you know, on some of these things? Or a 1,000 years from now, somebody will be like, they kind of didn't know about the thingamajig.
Yeah, there's definitely going to be things we will learn, but like the basic mechanisms of why like Hep A and E are spreading, you know, through refugee camps, we definitely get that.
You're right. It has not you know, sadly, horrifically, tragically, we're like, yeah, that was yesterday.
Still going strong, humanity.
Still going strong.
There are some other important things I see in terms of similarities between what you guys do and what, you know, people in medicine, particularly people active online, have to do. And that's sort of battling misinformation. And you guys try to go to great lengths to correct or at least put doubt on myths that don't have a lot of basis to them. You know, we do that too online, you know, even before COVID, but with vaccines and still to this day, we're constantly battling that. And you know, some of these things very obvious. Like, I think everyone would say, like, we understand why you as a doctor would be upset about someone having their kid drink bleach to cure their autism. But then there are certain things that people are like, well, why do you care if Gwyneth Paltrow convinces people to put a jade egg up their hoo-ha? like, what is the harm? And I have strong thoughts about this, but I want to hear why you guys feel it's important that the facts, as well as we can say them, are out there, and that you address or take down or battle myths whenever possible.
Yeah, so I don't want to comment on Gwyneth Paltrow's hoo-ha, but I will say that it is important. There's a few things here. And again, this is where I really am grateful to having sort of learned this with Mike and from Mike, starting out on sort of trying to be more than just a self-taught person and really understand how to do scholarship, right? And that is that, I said this before, that there is a commonality between law enforcement investigation, intelligence work, and historical inquiry. And that is what I would call sourcecraft, for lack of a better word. In other words, you investigate evidence, that you vet eyewitness testimony, that there's ways that you match data against other data, that you tackle your own biases in a really potent way, that you actually stop and ask yourself, do I believe this because I want to believe it? The sort of debate school tactics on steroids. And where does that get you? That gets you closer to, look, I don't know that we'll ever get to a complete truth, but the quest for truth really matters. And it matters especially now, Kava. And it matters for its own sake, because when you don't have regard for that, when that doesn't matter, that casual disregard for what is real versus what is story leaks into the discourse. And you see that now, and you see what the consequences of that now for ourselves and for society at large. The truth matters for its own sake. And that's a really, really critical thing. Now, when it comes specifically to history, and this was a crusade I kind of took up early on, and I want to be clear, it's certainly not unique to me. There's plenty of other people out there doing it, but I certainly did it with The Bronze Lie. George Orwell has an awful quote, "He who controls the past controls the future." And that's probably overstating it a bit. But the fact is that that disregard for truth allows, or rather is an angle that bad actors use to use history to tell a story to justify bad action. And you just heard, if you watch that friggin' execrable Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin, you watch Vladimir Putin misuse history to justify what he's doing in Ukraine and to basically butcher history and from it conclude that Ukraine is actually Russia, and therefore it's fine for me to upend a country, kill hundreds of thousands of people, like destroy the global, like it's just the suffering that his misuse of history engendered is unbelievable. Now, do I think that we're going to win the war in Ukraine by destroying Vladimir Putin's historical arguments for invasion? No, but I do know that one of the British historian, whose name I can't remember, Mike, if you know, let me know, Putin just put him on a sanctions list. In other words, Russia, if he had Russian assets, I mean, he doesn't care, he doesn't have Russian assets, but if he travels to Russia, he'll be arrested. His assets would be frozen if he owned anything in a Russian bank, that kind of thing. That's how much they care about his telling the truth about Ukraine's history. So I think there's sort of a double whammy there. One is that the truth matters for its own sake, for very powerful reasons. And the second is that, man, there's some there's some real bad people out there using history in a really nefarious sense.
Yeah.
What
I found is a very similar concept in medical misinformation. When there's a question or a doubt or it hasn't been fully explained, there's a vacuum and bad actors will fill that vacuum. And they'll fill that vacuum with something that they're trying to sell. That's just always how it is. And Putin sounds like no different.
I want to add one other thing to that. It isn't always bad action. Like, so what Mike has built his career on is actually taking well-meaning people who are really doing their best and updating the record, right, Mike? Like, and saying, hey, like, I get it. You thought crazy was over here. I understand why. No one's mad at you, but it was over there. Like, am I wrong, Mike? Like, that's...
Yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, but, you know, as Kave said, in the absence of information, misinformation prevails. And I'm against misinformation because I'm a historian. I want my facts. And and so, yeah, the fighting of what people believe is inevitable in this business, right? I mean, it's as a professor, it's like I'm, you know, having to unteach, right, what students have learned by watching the movies or whatever it is, right? You know, and look, you know, Ridley Scott didn't mean to destroy their history necessarily, right? He was just trying to tell a story or whatever, but students are like, I know exactly what it was. I saw it on TV. Right, you have to sort of, okay, I understand why you did that, right? I understand why you saw it that way. Yeah, that was a great movie, or no, that was actually a really terrible movie. Let's also talk about that.
Are we talking about Napoleon or aliens? Alien. He only did the alien. Yeah, sorry.
He only did Alien. Yeah.
Yeah.
James Cameron did Aliens, which was probably a better movie. But anyway. That desire to break the myth, because as Mike said, you know, this is you know, myths are a kind of entrance point to other things that are a problem. And if we kind of want to step it all back, right, we have to agree to the facts. And one of the things I think I love about history is that that's a journey in itself. And it's a journey without a final destination. Mm. I will never know. I mean, I just put a book out in November about the Battle of Agincourt. I will never know everything about that battle. I can't. I cannot. Even if I were there, I would not know everything. I would know my own individual experience, of course.
That's the fog of war, right?
That's the fog of war. Yeah. And I mean, you know, so even my own individual experience, right, would have these weird kind of ins and outs to it, right? Mm-hmm. But I certainly wouldn't know what the experience was on the other side. I certainly wouldn't know on, you know, this a field of battle is kind of sizable. What happened on the left flank? What's on the right flank? And when it comes to any historical moment, any historical thing, you cannot know. By just virtue of reality, you cannot know the fullness of it. What you can do is get ever and ever closer to that. And that journey is enormously fruitful in correcting the record.
This is so important, I think, for our medical listeners too, because what I want us to take as doctors and medical professionals is that we have to, to some degree, become historians, because it's already happening. I can already see the history of COVID being rewritten. And there's this revisionist history that's already happening from people who want to minimize it for their own reasons, want to put it down for as less than it was for whatever reason they have. Mm-hmm. And it's really important that as medical professionals, we don't allow that. We have to become, in our own way, historians to help preserve the record and the clarity of it.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, something you touched on at the beginning of the episode made me, like, the connection point that I had to it. You were describing how you go to these actual battlefields and look at the geography, and you describe, like, your eye lines and your, you know, what's obscuring your vision and just the terrain and stuff. If you want to see this on Thursday nights or Sunday all day or Monday nights or Sunday nights, watch an NFL football game.
and you will get this bird's eye view of all 22 positions on the field. And you will see people on Twitter say, why didn't he hit that guy? He was wide open 30 yards down the field. And what they don't know is you have a bird's eye view. Like, if you are behind that offensive line and that defensive line, and you've got cornerbacks and linebackers taking up your field of vision, you cannot see shit on that field quite often. It's miraculously, you know, it's miraculous that they hit these guys running down the field when they do, but it's like the armchair quarterbacking without knowing what it's like to be standing on that field and seeing it from a level perspective is wild. It's insane. And that's like a microcosm of all of these battles throughout history on every snap, just about.
That is an awesome, awesome analogy, Will. And I'm 100% going to steal that in a book. I'm 100% steal that because it's absolutely true. And, you know, the other part of that, right, is armchair quarterbacks are pausing, right, and slow-mo. Right?
Yeah. You're not doing the quarterback. Yeah,
you got 3 seconds, and that's that ball better be on the move, right? That's how much time you have to process, to come through all that.
Yes.
And on a field of battle, I played football. I've had my clock cleaned by a linebacker. It sucked.
It was bad. Yeah.
It was bad. But I was in pads. He was in pads. And his intention outside of metaphor was not to kill me. Whereas on the field of battle, it is life and literally death. Like if you do this wrong, so you also have a top of your analogy it's now the pressure of life and death and all that, man. The discombobulation is enormous, and the idea that so many people have that I can understand a battle by just looking at a map, kind of cool
bird's eye view.
Cool, calm, the blocks of color moving along. You're like,
why didn't he just make this decision? Why didn't he just do that?
And it's that would have worked. Like you couldn't do that. Yeah.
Seriously. This is also the limit of reenactment, experimental archaeology, which is something that I'm a big booster of, which is, people who put on the armor, pick up the weapons, and then fight to figure out how it all works. And that is a critical part of history, in my opinion. But one of its big limitations is that because we live in 2024 and killing each other is illegal, you cannot simulate the internality of this dude is trying to kill me. Like, you can't, nor can you simulate real wounds, what it's like to fight when you have an arrow in your shoulder, or like what it's like to fight when you have dysentery, and you're shitting yourself while you're out there. What it's, the terror of, being crushed or all of those things. You cannot in a modern society simulate that in reenactment. You can only simulate the equipment and some of the weight and some of the pressure, and that internality, which that Mike just described, is key to why people make the decisions they make and how battles unfold. I've had some of that experience in Iraq of feeling terrified when I was getting shot at, but it's also very, very different to get shot at than it is to be up close enough to someone. I've certainly been in fights in my life and I've done lots of reenactment fighting, but man, that is not the same. That is not the same at all.
So one question, I don't know if this will be the final one or not. Forgive me if you had another one. Have we seen through the evolution and advancements in modern warfare, have we seen Thermopylae be its last crucial transit point? Or do you think there is a situation in the future? I don't know if Einstein actually said it, like World War III will be fought with, nuclear bombs whatever, and then the next one will be fought with sticks and stones. But do you think we'll ever see it be as important as it has been in the past?
You want to take it first, Mike? I have a theory, but you go first.
And of course, absence of like all geopolitics and stuff. Yeah. Just technology speak.
I will tell you, I hope that it is. I hope that it is. As that's my human being.
Sure, sure.
Father of children. I hope that it is. Surely it's not. To go back to what I said earlier, if there's one thing we do as human beings, it's try to kill each other a lot. And this is a place where groups that are trying to kill each other across a certain region tend to go through and think that it's a good place to kill each other. So I'd be kind of shocked if in the rest of the humanity, it never happens again. I mean, that said, it's a different place to do it now because of geological changes, but I'd be kind of shocked. I don't know. What do you think, Mike?
I agree with you for the most part. And we have actually evidence of this, guys. You know, Mike's right. Was it Plato who said only the dead have seen the end of war? Like it's just, you know, we love this. And with stuff stirring up in Ukraine, with Russia actually on the front foot, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get funding to the Ukrainians so that we could actually hold these guys there. I firmly believe Putin is not going to stop, and we are going to see this spill out into the Balkans. And that is, like in a lump in it, that's awful close to Greece. But we also saw this, right? The final battle that we cover in 1941 is fought during World War II. You have Stuka dive bombers, you have heavy armor, you have howitzers. And at this point, the pass is much wider because silting and effluvium and other natural forces have caused the shore to extend by over a mile toward the Gulf. So it's a much broader flat plain in 1941. It's much harder to defend. And yet they still defend it. It was a holding action as the Anzacs, the Australian New Zealand Army Corps, evacuated Greece because the Wehrmacht were just rolling over everybody. But the fact that they still fought there, the fact that it's defensible characteristic with all those changes in technology, which are certainly, I mean, an aircraft in 1941 is very, very different from an aircraft now, but it's still flight, yeah. Right? That's still, and it was still, there was still fighting there, which does make me think that, you know, should war reach Greece again, that's still a choke point. It's still the gap in the mountain range, even though it's much, much harder to defend than it was.
Well, fantastic. We'll have you guys back on when that happens. If there's still an internet at that point. We're about to close up. Before we do, before we close up this episode on Greek history, I would be remiss to not mention that the current prime minister of Greece is a guy named Kyriakos Mitsotakis, which the first name translates in Farsi roughly to dick pussy. So again, Persians get the last laugh. Friends, what can we plug for you? Let's talk about the book. Where can people get it? Let's get them to read it.
All right. So it's The Killing Ground, a biography of Thermopylae. It's available wherever fine books are sold. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it in Barnes & Noble. Let me actually plug one of Mike's books. So we've talked today about Mike's A Battle Is Its Ground. He has these axioms of how you study history. And those axioms are how I really professionalize my own approach to history. And he details them all in a book called Never Greater Slaughter. Mike, forgive me. This is one of your older books. I know you've got newer ones you need to sell, but this is the one I think that if you're trying to understand how Mike and through his tutelage, how I now approach battlefields, he really lays it out in the beginning of this book. Another advantage of it is it's a really short and active, like fighty, fun book. So if you're looking to dip your toe into not just history, military history, but historiography, that's Mike's best book for that. And it's got that great title, Never Greater Slaughter.
Right on. Is there any TV stuff that we should plug?
Well, Mike, we'll plug you again. What do you got coming up, Mike? You got the two History Hit specials?
The History Hit specials on the Battle of Shrewsbury came out at the end of December, I think they came out. On the Battle of Shrewsbury, which is great fun for medical folk out there. We do talk about how does one get an arrow that went 6 inches deep into the skull of the Prince of Wales? How do you get that out in 1403?
Classic MCAT question. You would be surprised.
It is classic. It is wild. They did it. He lived. He became Henry V. And he ultimately, of course, wins at Agincourt in 1415, which was the subject of my last book that was not with Mike Cole, which came out in November, The Battle of Agincourt. Agincourt Battle of the Scarred King, it's called.
And where is that found, the video, or the, is that on the
History, History Hit? Is a streaming service. So yeah, if History people want to, yeah, History Hit, they subscribe to that. Yeah, they've got I do a few things for them. They're fun to work with. We've done some other history stuff, Mike and I both. But yeah, Mike, you know, since he pitched one of my books there, you know, The Bronze Lie is a terrific book. You had him on for that before. Whatever episode that was, you should go back and listen to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Kaveh made me read that one too, damn it.
Did he? Did he? It was good though, right?
It was really good. It was really good, yeah. Yes.
It was good. There's a Livingston fellow, I think, did a quote for it, and it was really well received. I heard.
Shit. Endorsed by him.
Yeah, I heard it. I heard it was really like wow. He read it and thought it was good. That's,
well, Spider-Man endorsed yours.
Spider-Man. Yeah. Tom Holland.
Tom Holland read this. Boyfriend of Zendaya, currently in the movie Dune 2. So that's huge praise. You know, that guy's busy as hell.
One of the great swing and misses of my life. This is before Tom Holland ever endorsed the book that I wrote, and thank God that he did after this great move. When I was on Twitter, I sent him, to Tom Holland the historian, some animated GIF of Kirsten Dunst kissing Spider-Man and saying like, "I just love doing this." And shockingly, he did not respond because he gets that exact joke every single time. Day. It has been since the movie came out. So
okay, it's also a miss because that's the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man.
Yeah, that's wrong. Like, that's, yeah.
Right.
That's
like, a lot wrong.
Yeah.
That's probably why he didn't respond.
Yeah, he was like, that's not even the other Tom Holland.
Yeah.
Does that get it right? It was episode 205. This is Sparta from the House of Pod, if you want to listen to that one.
There you go. Episode 205, everybody.
Thank you guys. You're fantastic. This is super fun. I really enjoyed this book and I learned a ton from it.
Thanks, man.
Thank you to Dr. Jason Rosenbaum for ad copy. If you haven't already, rate and review us on iTunes. And if you want, I'm trying to get off Twitter and I'm in the process of completely selling out. So you can follow me on TikTok. Where I'll put up some videos there. I don't know.
Dance videos, comment. Dance videos.
Well, I mean, what other kind of videos would a doctor do? thank you both. Thank you all so much. It was such a blast having you all.
Thanks so much for having us.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to say. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.